and get the hell out of here, he laughed. I didn't. I returned to my car in the lot out front. The rain had stopped again. I sat in my car with the windows down, smelling that after-rain smell. Even though I'd pointed Dan in the right direction, I'd abused his trust. Another relationship was on the rocks. I was having some kind of night. Chapter 43. I hit the sack without flossing or brushing my teeth. Jill didn't wake when I kissed her goodnight, and that was probably for the best. As I was drifting off to sleep, I remembered I'd forgotten my prescription pills for the second night in a row. If skipping a few days' worth of statins and alpha blockers was what finally killed me, then I deserved to be weeded out of the gene pool. When I woke up, I found myself in the middle of the cemetery. I was lying on my back, with the sun beating down on my face. A gentle breeze was rustling the unmowed grass. Far away, I heard a thump-thump, 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 like a racing heartbeat. The louder it grew, the more distinct it became. It wasn't a heartbeat at all. It was the trotting of hooves, big, heavy horse hooves. I sat up just as a white horse emerged from over a hill. A faceless rider snapped the reins and flew down the slope of the hill, dodging broken tombstones and barren trees. The hooves pounded louder and louder, as if the sound was coming from inside my own head. Thump-thump, thump-thump, thump-thump. The closer the horse came, the more indistinct its shape. It was so white that it was glowing. Looking at it was like staring into the sun during an eclipse. I was forced to look away. Just when it sounded like the horse was about to run me down, the animal came to an abrupt stop. It was so close now I could feel its warm breath on me. I was vaguely aware that I was dreaming, but every sensation was so vibrant. I desperately wanted it all to be real. Need a hand? I peeked at the figure on the horse's back through cracks in my fingers. My eyes slowly adjusted to the light emanating from the horse, and the figure came into focus. It was Barack Obama, clad in a white toga. He pulled me to my feet. Thanks, I said. You wouldn't believe the dream I've had. Try me. You came to see me one night and said my friend had been hit by a train and... Is that a unicorn? I asked, squinting at the curled horn sprouting up between the horse's ears. I call her Little Beast. I ran my fingers through the unicorn's silken hair, which left rainbow glitter on my hand. The headache that had plagued me off and on all weekend was gone. There was no pain in my knee or anywhere else in my body. Is this heaven? No, Barack said. It's Iowa. And then suddenly we weren't in the cemetery anymore. We were on a baseball diamond at the edge of a cornfield. The stalks towered over my head, whispering in the wind. I don't understand, I stammered. Hop on, Barack said. We don't have much time. Where are we going? To set up your campaign headquarters, of course. I haven't even decided if I'm running, I said. What I truly wanted, honest to God, was for somebody new to step up in the Democratic Party. Somebody younger. Somebody with fresh ideas. Somebody who had two knees that worked. This was all happening too fast. It's now or never, Joe. What's it going to be? Before I could give him an answer, my alarm went off. Chapter 44. I woke up face down on the top of the bedspread, still dressed in my clothes from the night before. Daylight filtered into the room through the blinds. I didn't have to look at my clock to know that I'd hit the snooze button more than once. Thankfully, Jill was used to that by now. I rolled onto my back. Jill's side of the bed was made. She was probably downstairs reading. I could only imagine what she'd thought when she awakened to find some old guy in a hoodie and sagging jean shorts next to her. I prayed she'd forgive me for scaring the bejesus out of her, but I knew it was going to take a lot more than prayer. A trip to the florist might be in order. This time I'd open my wallet for the roses. There was a yellow sticky note in the middle of the bathroom mirror. There's a bag of frozen peas in the freezer for your face. Love, Jill. I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. My face bulged in odd places, places I wasn't even aware I'd been hit. The bruising underneath my eye had ripened into a good old-fashioned shiner, the kind you get from taking a fastball to the face. The only good news was that it looked worse than it felt. My left knee, on the other hand, was a different story. It looked like an overripe peach. As I changed into my khakis, sharp pain shot up my thigh like lightning bolts. There was no telling when it would give out next. I took one look at the stairs and decided to hold the railing with both hands. I couldn't smell any coffee. "Jill?" I called out on my way down. No answer. There was a stack of mail waiting for me on the kitchen table, but no Jill. I shuffled through it disinterestedly. A couple of magazines I'd subscribed to because of a fundraiser my grandkids were mixed up in. A utility bill which was always paid automatically online. A letter addressed to me with no return address, either fan mail or hate mail, neither of which I was in a hurry to read. Jill had left another note for me on the cereal box above the fridge. At brunch with Alice, took champ, bottomless mimosas, so back by... Love, Jill. That explained that. While eating breakfast, I looked around for something to read, but the newspaper was in the living room. It seemed so far away, now that I'd sat down. It was going to be impossible to hide my injured knee from Jill. Not that I'd even contemplated it. Okay, maybe I'd thought about it. I wouldn't say I contemplated it, though. I picked up the New Yorker. The cartoons always made me guffaw, but the writing wasn't my speed. We had 6 months' worth of back issues stacked on the back of our toilet. One day the tower was going to tip and break someone's neck while they were doing their business on the John. The subscription was in Jill's name, so she'd be the one getting sued, not me. The cartoons didn't grab me this time. Not after the weekend I'd had. I decided to open the fan letter. Jill liked to tease me about them, until we got a couple of threatening ones. The Secret Service always dealt with those. Since then, I'd just been stacking the letters in my office. I sometimes thought about hiring an assistant to handle the paperwork, but didn't have the income to support the idea just yet. Maybe I needed to do some of those Wall Street speaking gigs that Barack had been making bank on. Trouble was, as soon as you went down that route, you were just spoon-feeding ammunition to your political opponents. It was only trouble if I ran for office again, though. I peeked into the envelope to make sure there wasn't any white powder before removing the letter. You can't be too careful these days. As if you ever could. It looked reasonably anthrax-free, though. I unfolded the letter. It was a regular-sized sheet of typing paper, folded into thirds. The letter was addressed to me. Both front and back were covered in cursive handwriting. The penmanship was legible, but looked like it had been scrawled out on an uneven surface. In several spots, the pen had poked through the paper. At the bottom of the second page, the letter was signed, "Yours, Finn Donnelly." I dropped my spoon onto the table. Of course. This was why Finn had printed off my address. He didn't have a cell phone. He just searched online and printed the first page he'd found, a map. I read the letter through once, and then a second time just to be sure I hadn't imagined any of it. I hadn't. Breakfast time was over. Upstairs, I dug out my brown leather bomber jacket from the back of our walk-in closet. I'd already replaced my T-shirt with a navy blue polo shirt. Now I undid the top button. I picked up my Ray-Bans from the nightstand, slipped them on. I couldn't have looked more like Joe Biden than if I'd been playing myself in a Joe Biden biopic. Finn Donnelly didn't need Joe Tingler right now. Finn Donnelly needed Joe Biden. I stopped in my office. The Medal of Freedom was sitting on my desk, where I'd left it Friday night. When Barack had bestowed it upon me, he'd said I was as good a man as God ever created. Even if the President and I were no longer speaking, even if we never spoke again, just looking at this medal was enough to remind me of all that I'd once been, of all that I could be again, of all that I could be right now, today, for Finn. I slipped the medal inside my jacket pocket and headed out. As the garage door lifted, I started the Challenger. It rumbled to life. Every muscle in my body was vibrating, as if I was in an electric massage chair. A good massage was what I would need after this was all said and done. But first, Wilmington Station. And then Baltimore, where Finn's duffel bag was waiting for me. Chapter 45. I was waiting like a cat on hot bricks at the counter of the Baltimore Penn Station Lost and Found. The employee had disappeared into the back room to search for the duffel bag. He was young, portly, and had a bad haircut. Most kids had bad haircuts these days. Too many of them looked like Hitler Youth. Heck, too many of them were Hitler Youth. The kid seemed decent enough, but he was taking a lot longer in back than I'd expected. Was he on the phone with security? I worried I was being watched, but I didn't dare look around. No reason to act overly suspicious. I was just a guy picking up a duffel bag full of heroin. I'd taken the first train out of Wilmington, a northeast regional. It was the slower cousin of the high-speed Acela, but much faster than driving bumper to bumper on I-95. I'd already spent too much time behind the wheel over the weekend. The regional train was cheaper, though, and that meant more riffraff. Since business class had been full, too, it turned out to be the first time in decades that Amtrak's most famous passenger sat amongst the working stiffs. Instead of feeling out of place, however, I discovered that I felt right at home. I struck up a conversation with a lovely woman seated next to me, and we chatted about our grandkids all the way to Baltimore. It was a welcome distraction from the chaos of the previous week. But it wasn't enough to distract me from the letter. Dear Joe, I hope this letter finds you well. Things are not going so good on my end. In January, Darlene had a stroke. She is over at Baptist Manor. We do not know if she will recover. All I want to do is bring her home. As you can imagine, the costs involved are more than we can afford. This is not to excuse my actions, because there is no excuse. I met some men one morning at Waffle Depot who told me, "How would you like to make some extra money?" I said, "What do I have to do?" They said, "Take this bag with you to D.C. and give it to somebody." I asked what was in the bag. They said, "Do you want money or not?" I knew the men were drug dealers. Still, I said, "Yes." The first couple of runs went fine. The money was good. I didn't open the bags, but I had an idea what was in them. We, Amtrak conductors, got a notice to be on the lookout for increased trafficking, specifically opioids. Agencies were doing stings on the interstate, and the DEA thought dealers might try alternate routes. I had to laugh at that one, because the DEA was a little late to the party. Last week, my daughter tells me a girl in her dorm overdosed on heroin. "I thought only junkies overdosed," I said. "This girl was a college kid at Georgetown, on the volleyball team. Good grades." She lived. The next might not. I never opened the bags, so I can't say for sure what I was transporting, but it wasn't marijuana. The dealers were paying me too much to move a little pot. There is a black duffel bag in Lost and Found at the station in Baltimore. I told the man at the counter someone left it in the men's room. I think they believe me. The perks of wearing a uniform. The drug dealers are in a motorcycle group, the Murdertown Marauders. I do not know their real names, but the one guy who gave me the bags and the money calls himself Texas. I do not know what the men are going to do when they find out I didn't deliver the bag. The men say they are being protected by the police, so I cannot go to them. I do not know if I can trust other government agencies. You are the only one I can trust right now who might be able to help me. Your friend, Finn Donnelly. P.S. I am sorry. Give my best to Dr. Biden. The Lost and Found employee finally returned. He was holding a black duffel bag. Instead of being relieved, my heart sped up. I could feel sweat forming on my brow. It was real. It was suddenly all too real. "Is this it?" he asked. I had no way of knowing. It was black and it was a duffel bag. It would have to do. "That looks like it," I said. I tried to smile like I'd just been reunited with a long-lost friend. I suppose it was true in a way. The kid heaved it onto the counter with a huff. He reminded me that in the future, I might want to place a luggage tag on my bags. I said I'd keep it in mind and reach for the bag. "Wait," he said, slapping his forehead. "I forgot to have you identify what's in the bag. I'm so sorry, Mr. Vice President." I kept my grin up, but inwardly was hitting the panic button. "What's in the bag?" "I know it sounds stupid that you'd want to take someone else's old gym clothes," he said. "I trust you. Go ahead and take it. But you can't be too careful these days, especially after 9/11. He whispered the date like it was a naughty word. Just so you know, we go through everything that's brought in. Not to be nosy, just to be safe. You might want to make sure everything's in there. Sometimes things get misplaced. The kid didn't look old enough to remember how lax security had been before September 11th, but I let it slide. I'm sure all of my old gym clothes are in there, I said, taking the bag off the counter. It wasn't much heavier than a bag of gym clothes. Could there really be enough drugs in it to be worth killing someone over? Nobody stopped me as I crossed the concourse. Nobody swarmed in with guns drawn and told me to drop the bag and get on the ground. Still, I lowered my head and quickened my pace until I reached the men's room. Inside a locked stall, I set the bag on the back of the toilet. There was piss all over the seat. I'd never understand how some men couldn't aim their pistols. Half of them probably had handguns at home, too. A terrifying prospect. I unzipped the duffel bag quickly, like I was tearing off a band-aid. I knew there was no reason to draw things out. It wasn't going to change what was inside. I breathed deep and looked. Sneakers, a couple of t-shirts, a pair of shorts, a Monster energy drink. That was it. I rifled through the bag, feeling for a false bottom or hidden compartments. Nothing. Finn had given me one job, and in the end I'd failed him. Taylor and his biker buddies had been searching for the bag all week, in Darlene's room at Baptist Manor, at the Donnelly's home in Riverside. Had they beat me here? I stuffed everything back in the bag. I could return to the lost and found counter later, when somebody else was working, see if there was another black duffel bag. Damn you, Finn, I thought. I knew why he hadn't left his name and address inside the bag, but he could have done something. Of course, it was futile to get upset with him. He'd been working with what he had. He hadn't planned this out. He'd been acting impulsively. I could hear Jill's voice in my head. Now, who does that remind you of, Joe? Wait. I pulled the energy drink out again. Finn and I might have both been impulsive, but we both had something else in common. We didn't drink alcohol, and we didn't drink caffeine. The likelihood of Finn buying one of these highfalutin beverages was zero to zilch. I popped the tab. Though the drink was supposed to be carbonated, there was no release of air. The can weighed about the same as it would if it were filled with liquid, but there wasn't any liquid inside. Instead, there was a plastic bag, packed with bright white powder and taped up tight. Good night, nurse. Chapter 46. I boarded the Acela and took my seat. I'd bought a one-way return ticket on the faster train because I needed to get back to Wilmington as quickly as possible, and there was no faster train in the United States than the Acela. I was back in first class, where there would be less of a chance of talking about my grandkids. People don't pay first-class prices to talk about their families. It wasn't that I'd exhausted the topic, far from it, but it was impossible to think about anything other than the duffel bag in the overhead compartment. I debated calling someone from inside the station, but I couldn't think of a single person eager to help me. Lieutenant Esposito was in charge of the investigation, or she had been, until she told me the books were basically closed. What I'd handed Dan last night should have been enough to reopen the case, although there was a chance he'd shuffled it over to the narcotics division. The DEA was involved. What their angle was is anyone's guess. All of this was complicated by the fact that the Marauders alleged they had help from inside the Wilmington PD. I sure hoped this was a bluff. As much as I personally disliked Esposito, she was a good cop. The thought of her or anyone in the department being corrupt was difficult to stomach. Some of my biggest and most loyal supporters work in law enforcement, and I believe they have some of the toughest jobs in this country. But I also believe they're not infallible. None of us are. Not me, not Barack. Well, maybe Barack. He would know exactly what to do, exactly who to contact. As much as it infuriated me sometimes, Barack could always be counted on to have the right answer. I looked out the window as the train beside us pulled out in the opposite direction. I felt the metal in my pocket. Had I really spoken to Barack Obama for the last time in my life? It didn't seem possible. Yet there wasn't any other way to interpret how we'd parted ways. Neither of us had said goodbye, but it had been goodbye all the same. "Is this seat taken?" a man asked, hovering in the aisle beside me. Without looking up, I motioned that the seat across the table was free. "Thanks," the man said, sliding into the padded chair. It was Dan Capriotti. His appearance on the train was so unexpected, I was having trouble forming thoughts, let alone words. "Lift your shirt," he said. "Excuse me?" He moved his jacket to the side to show the butt of his pistol. "You heard me. Lift your shirt." The first-class cabin was filling quickly. I waited for the attendant to pass by, and then I leaned in close to Dan. "I'm not armed," I whispered. "Don't make this any more difficult than it has to be, Joe." I sighed and looked around. When I was certain there weren't any prying eyes, I flashed Dan my naked gut for half a second. "Happy? Now your backside," he snapped. I turned around in my seat and showed off my lower back. "I think there's been some misunderstanding. The bag isn't mine. I was..." He put a finger to his lips as another passenger scooted past. There were dark circles under Dan's eyes, like he hadn't slept well last night. Or at all. Had the department had me under surveillance? Regardless, he'd caught me red-handed with a duffel bag. "There's a letter," I said in a hushed tone. "It explains everything." He glanced around. There were no other police around, unless they were plain clothes, like Dan. "Let's see it," he said wearily. I dug it out of my pocket. "It's from Finn." He put on a pair of reading glasses and scanned the letter, front and back. The engineer blew the whistle, and the train slowly pulled out of the station. There were several open seats in first class, including one across the aisle from us. I didn't know if the relative privacy decreased or increased my anxiety. "He mailed this to you?" Dan asked. "The envelope's at home. It was postmarked in Maryland. The date was smudged, but it showed up either Friday or Saturday. I didn't see it until this morning, or else I'd have told you about it sooner." He returned his glasses to inside his jacket. "You could have saved yourself the round trip and called and told me this morning." "I could have," I conceded. "Lucky for you, you happened to be in Baltimore this morning." "It wasn't luck. I followed you here." "Because you suspected me of something. Because I knew you weren't finished playing cops and robbers." The first-class attendant interrupted us with a smile and dropped a couple menus on our table. It was another new hire. I didn't recognize her, and I didn't introduce myself. She moved on to the next row. The train was winding out of town at 35-40 miles per hour. The Acela wouldn't hit its maximum speed of 150 until later on, and only for a couple of short stretches of track. There were too many twists, too many turns. I'd always wanted to take a high-speed train out west, where there was enough room to really fly. "You know why they call Delaware the Diamond State?" Dan asked. "Thomas Jefferson," I said. "He called the state a jewel because of its prime location on the eastern seaboard. It's also a prime location for drug trafficking. Delaware's on a direct route between New York City and D.C., with Philly and Baltimore along the way. I-95 was practically paved with illegal drugs until the DEA started cracking down." I knew all of this. We were in the midst of a public health crisis that had already proved more lethal than the crack cocaine epidemic of the 80s. "The Marauders worked out a pretty decent plan," I said. "Finn had the inside track, so to speak, but the bad guys didn't count on one thing."
"What's that?"
"Finn Donnelly had a conscience."
"You believe all this?"
Dan said, waving the letter. "What other explanation is there?"
"Maybe he didn't feel he was getting paid what he deserved. Maybe he wanted a bigger piece of the pie."
"And then he decided to tell me about it?" I said. "No, that doesn't make any sense. Not unless you think Finn and I were in cahoots, were you?" "How long have we known each other, Dan? I can't believe you'd even ask that."
"You're telling me that when you read this letter, you didn't wonder if I was the one protecting the Marauders, not even for a second?"
"It may have crossed my mind, but..."
"Relax," he said. "I'm just messing with you. Had to ask, though."
My blood pressure was returning to normal, or what passed for normal these days.
"So what happens now?" "The way I see it, I turn this paper over to my boss, who's been working with the DEA. Your friend's name gets dragged through the mud, your name gets dragged through the mud. Everybody loses. But that's life, right?"
He paused to gauge my reaction. I didn't have one.
"Or there's a second option," he continued, his voice low. "We forget about this letter. Your friend can rest quietly. No one ever learns about his trafficking scheme. And most importantly, you walk away clean. The bag, I said. What about the bag? Dan shrugged. I'll turn it in anonymously, like one of those babies left on church doorsteps. Don't you need it to convict Taylor Brownsford? The attendant stopped for our lunch orders, but neither of us were hungry. Dan watched her walk away, and then turned back to me. Taylor's dead. What happened? I had to recuff his hands behind his back, you know. His hands were free for half a second, and he went for my gun. There was a struggle. The gun went off. Dan paused. There was no way he was going to turn state's witness and rat his brothers out. If an outlaw biker flips, he's as good as dead. I took off my sunglasses and rubbed between my eyes. My headache from yesterday was coming back. Everything all right, Joe? I'd rather we went with the first option, that's all, I said, replacing my glasses. I know there will be fallout from the letter, but I can handle it. Whatever happens, happens. What's important is getting the truth out there. I couldn't live with myself if I had to keep the letter from his daughter. She deserved to know what happened. If that's your only objection, we can let her know. There's this old joke. Two Irishmen are talking. One has a bag of donuts. He tells the other, if you can guess how many donuts are in my bag, you can have them both. I waited for Dan to laugh, but apparently he'd heard that one before. I continued. What I'm trying to say is the Irish aren't known for keeping secrets. We like to talk, and I can't guarantee the truth wouldn't just slip out of me at some point. So let's get everything logged as evidence. I'll go on the record. Whatever you need me to do. Dan stashed the letter in his jacket. You're right. I hope I didn't offend you. Offend me? I know you're all about doing the right thing. I'm just trying to look out for you, that's all. I appreciate it. Don't get me wrong, I really do appreciate it. It's tempting to just forget about this letter. It would make my life easier. Lord knows it would make your life easier, too, I'd bet. He shrugged. Paperwork's part of the job. Still, this thing is going to blow up. Whoever's covering for the marauders down at the station isn't going to be happy. There might be a target on your back. You handle yourself, I handle myself. He glanced around the cabin, then leaned across the table. Say, did you open the bag? Is it all there? There's something there. Whether it's all of it or not, I don't know. Looked like a pound or two, sealed up. It's good you didn't touch it. Fentanyl is dangerous stuff. Touch it without rubber gloves and it can kill you, he snapped his fingers, just like that. Fentanyl? A synthetic opioid. Dealers cut heroin with it to increase the potency. Fentanyl is 50 times more powerful than heroin. That's why you can fit over $1 million worth into a monster can. Fentanyl. Of course, regular heroin was passé. Kids today wanted heroin as extreme as their energy drinks. Energy drinks. I hadn't told Dan about the energy drink. There was a slim chance he'd gotten the detail from Taylor. But Dan had said Taylor wasn't going to sing. Dan might have known traffickers used vacuum-sealed packages hidden in cans, but there was only one way Dan could have known the brand. My left leg was bouncing under the table like a Jack Russell Terrier. The first-class attendant was a few rows away, pushing a cart. Everything okay, Joe? Dan asked. The room was spinning around me. Stomach's just a little upset. If you'll excuse me, don't let me stop you, he said, gesturing to the aisle. I'm getting a drink. You want a Sprite or something? Thanks, but I'll manage, I said, heading for the restroom at the end of the car. I didn't look over my shoulder, but I knew that Dan was watching my every move. The train was just about halfway to our destination, humming along at over 100 miles per hour on the open track. In approximately 20 minutes, we would pull into Wilmington Station. Once the doors opened, Dan would step off. And I knew that I'd never see that duffel bag or letter again. Chapter 47. Pick up, pick up! The line rang and rang. After 5 rings, Barack answered. Thank God! I shouted, doing a poor job of staying quiet inside the first-class lavatory. But I'm not in right now, so if you leave a message after the beep... I listened to the beep, slack-jawed. By the time Barack discovered I'd called and then tried to ring me back, it would be too late. I slumped back on the toilet seat. The fact that Dan had come after me by himself and then suggested we just forget the letter had raised my suspicions. The fact that he knew about the monster can all but confirmed them. I didn't know if Dan was the dirty cop protecting the marauders. I just knew that something wasn't adding up. I wanted somebody with some authority to meet us at Wilmington Station to ensure that Dan didn't go back on his word. I tried dialing Esposito, but she didn't answer either. And I didn't have the direct numbers to the DEA agents who'd hit the Donnellys' home. There were any number of law enforcement agencies I could call. Getting them to believe my identity was a laughable prospect at best. There was a saying in the Biden family, if you have to ask for help, it's already too late. Wait. The train was scheduled to arrive at Wilmington Station in 20 minutes. But what if it was delayed? Regular riders knew that delays were part and parcel of traveling on Amtrak. The frequent holdups were usually attributable to the freight companies who owned the tracks and gave priority to their own trains. If I could manufacture a delay, I could buy some time for Barack or Esposito to get back to me. Heading straight to the conductor on board would raise Dan's suspicions. Luckily, I didn't need to get to the conductor directly. I flipped excitedly through my contacts until I found the number I was looking for. The Wilmington station manager, Grant. There was a loud knock on the door. "Somebody's in here!" I shouted. When I returned to my phone, the screen was dead. I tried powering it back on. No luck. I hadn't plugged it in last night and hadn't charged it in the car on the way to the station. Jill had stuck one of those mobile charges in my Christmas stocking last year, but for all I knew, it was still in the stocking, somewhere in our basement. I'd figure out something, though. I always did. When I returned to my seat, Dan was missing. Probably in one of the other restrooms, I thought. Either that or he decided to hit the cafe car. 5 minutes passed, however, and he hadn't returned. I glanced around once more for him and pulled the duffel bag down from the overhead bin. I tried to look as casual as possible as I rifled through it, but there was no disguising my panic. The energy drink was gone. Chapter 48. My most incriminating evidence was gone. I should have stopped to copy the letter before heading out of the house. I always knew my lack of forethought would land me in a pickle. I never imagined the pickle would be this big. The first-class car was the last passenger car in the train. That left 5 other cars where Dan could be waiting, 4 business-class cars, and the cafe car sandwiched in between, all of which I had precious few minutes to search. If Dan debarked in Wilmington before I could stop him, it would be his word against mine. My word carried a lot of weight, but so did Dan's. He was a decorated officer. To accuse him of wrongdoing without hard proof wouldn't earn me any favors. I charged into the next car, full of business-class passengers. A few faces looked up, but most people were in their own little worlds, pecking at their cell phones. I moved quickly down the center aisle, checking each seat. The restroom at the end of the car was unlocked. I checked inside just to be sure Dan wasn't there. No dice. My luck was no better in the next car, either. Then came the cafe car. At a glance, I could tell Dan wasn't there because there were only a handful of seats for passengers. I passed through as fast as I could without bending my legs. Mall walking, Jill called it. "Virgin Daiquiri, Mr. Biden?" asked the cafe car attendant. He had a thin, wispy mustache. I could have asked him to contact the conductor for me. Any of the first-class attendants could have put me in touch with the conductor as well. Unfortunately, Dan was armed. I couldn't risk involving any of these good people in my confrontation. Dan had likely killed Taylor Brownsford to protect his secret. He might kill again. My only hope was that I could talk him into doing the right thing. If I could appeal to him as his friend. "Just getting some exercise," I said with a nod. I scanned every face in the next car, but there was still no Dan. Had I passed him already? There was zero possibility he'd jumped off the train. That was suicide, even at 20 miles an hour, let alone 120. Had he forced himself into the power car at the head of the train? Impossible, I thought. He wouldn't risk drawing that kind of attention. Dan might have been a criminal, but he wasn't crazy. He was planning to get away with this, to walk off with the motherlode. His only obstacle was me. I stepped into the vestibule between the last two cars. As soon as the door behind me closed, I was blindsided with a bear hug tackle from the left. My lungs went flat like a couple of whoopee cushions. I didn't recognize my assailant until he had me pinned against the exit door. It was the speed demon biker with a southern accent who I realized was in all likelihood the one Finn called Texas. Dan stepped through the automatic doors.
I know what you're thinking right now, Joe. You're thinking, why, Dan, why? Something like that, I said, gasping for air under the weight of the biker.
Dan refused to look me in the eye.
I'm retiring next year, and it terrifies me. The state pension fund is depleted. I've got no savings. I've been shot and stabbed more times than I can count, and I can count pretty well for a blue-collar guy. What kind of thanks do I get? A Christmas card every year from Joe Biden, champion of law enforcement. Not signed. Not even a paper card. An e-card. I can take you off the mailing list, I said. Look at you. You're a decade older than me. You were the freaking vice president of the United States. What do you have to show for it? A house in the suburbs that you still owe money on. A vacation home on a bed of rocks that can only charitably be called a beach. A couple of cars that you haven't paid off. You've got nothing. I have a family. I have a legacy. I had a legacy once, too. But a legacy doesn't pay the bills. A legacy doesn't put food on the table. A legacy will get you a room in Baptist Manor someday, and not much more. That's why I started taxing these bastards. The marauders? All the criminals. You want to do business in my town? You need to pay for the privilege. Finn decided to go into business for himself, and that's where his trouble started. I was seething inside, but had stopped pushing back against Texas. He was too big, too strong. My only hope is to conserve my energy. Dan went on. As soon as I found out he had a sick wife, I knew he was a liability. And when the duffel bag went missing, well, he forced my hand. I can't skim money that isn't there. He wrenched the phone from my pocket. As soon as he saw it wouldn't power on, he smiled. He knew there was little chance I'd called somebody for help. If I had, I wouldn't have come looking for him. You killed Finn, I said. He stuffed the phone back in my pocket, where it nestled next to my Medal of Freedom. Taylor roughed your friend up in his motel room. He was in bad shape when I arrived. He was bleeding like a burst pipe all over the floor. He still wouldn't talk, so I hit him one time. One time! And his head caved in like a rotted pumpkin. It's scary how fragile our bodies become as we age, isn't it? So you laid him on the tracks and staged it to look like an overdose. Pretty sloppy work, I said. The longer I kept him talking, the greater the chance that somebody would cross through the vestibule between cars. No one was ever going to take a second look, not in that part of town. And then the next conductor found that printout with your address in his travel orders, and things started to get complicated. Until I read the letter today, I thought you had a hand in this mess. I honestly wasn't sure where the bag ended up. Drugs are one cookie jar I've never stuck my hand in. You should know that. You and I were friends. Friends? He shot back. I worked security for your rallies a few times when I was off duty. You weren't a friend. You were a job. He couldn't have known what I'd been going through with Barack, but his words stung nonetheless. Maybe adults weren't meant to have friends. We could have acquaintances, and we could have co-workers. We could have bosses and employees. But friends? Friends were for children. It was time for me to grow up. Dan unlocked the side panel that operated the exit doors. At first I thought he was hoping to be the first one off the train. Then I realized he didn't need to make a quick getaway, not if Texas tossed me out of the moving train first. He's going to keep the drugs for himself, I told the biker, trying to sow a seed of discontent. That's been his plan all along. Texas grinned. The fentanyl? We never found it. Of course. How could I have been so blind? You're both working together to screw over the club. Dan pressed his hand on the latch. If he opened the door right now, all three of us would be sucked out. What can I say? If you see your shot, you have to take it. The bag was lost. The marauders don't need to know it was found. It's the perfect crime. He killed Taylor, I told Texas. The biker looked surprised, but not shocked. Taylor was a moron, he said. He was never going to earn his colors. Taylor nearly torpedoed this entire operation by picking up the watch that fell out of Finn's pocket, Dan said. An idiot like that doesn't deserve to live. He sealed his own death warrant the day he was born. You, on the other hand, he smiled at me. You're too smart for your own damn good, Joe.
Through the windows of the exit door, I could see that we were on the outskirts of Wilmington. Soon the train would be slowing down. I just had to keep stalling. I had about as much chance as a Democrat in Alabama to stop Dan from making his getaway. If I was lucky, though, I could at least escape without winding up splattered along the side of the tracks. Dan nodded to Texas. My time had run out. So had his. I headbutted the biker in the nose with my forehead. There was a sickening crunch as bone struck cartilage. Blood erupted from his nose, and he staggered backward. I'd never done anything like that in my life. One more hit and I could take him down. Before I could charge him, something hard as steel pressed into my right temple. Dan's gun. "You won't get away with this," I said. "There will be an inquiry. There will be..." "I don't think so. Every year, 5 or 6 passengers open these doors while the train's in motion. Usually they're old and confused, just like you. I'm sure people will come forward and testify that you've been acting strange this past week. Delusional. Talking about conspiracy theories." Dan pressed a button inside the control panel. The exit door opened with a whoosh. Wind whistled into the train, popping my ears. "Goodbye, Joe." Before I could even come up with some witty last words, Dan clubbed me in the temple with the butt of his pistol. Stars flashed before my eyes. I was in so much pain that all I wanted to do was lie down and go to sleep. "You got knocked down," I heard my father's voice say in my head. "Now it's time to get up. Get up, Joe. Get up." I staggered on my feet, but Dan had the advantage by a country mile. He grabbed the back of my shirt and hurled me like a shot put through the open door. My legs went out from underneath me, and the world turned upside down. Chapter 49. I'd heard that in our final moments, we see our entire lives flash before our eyes. But I had more urgent things to worry about. Tumbling out, I'd managed to catch the doorframe with my left hand. Physics pinned my body against the side of the train. I'd been spared, if only momentarily. My Ray-Bans were laying shattered on the rocks 100 yards back, a preview of what would happen if I let go. If I was lucky, if I wasn't lucky, I'd get sucked underneath the train, where the wheels would have their way with me. My fingers were slipping from the doorframe one by one. My pinky was the first to go, then my ring finger. I tried to swing a leg back up inside the train, but the high-velocity forces working against me were too strong. I needed more core strength. That was what Jill would have said. A year or two's worth of daily sit-ups and crunches would tighten my abs right up. Unfortunately, I didn't have a year or two. My middle finger slipped free. I was down to my final moments. Review or not, I'd lived a good life. I closed my eyes and pinched my last 2 fingers into the frame as hard as I could, hoping for another few seconds so I could make peace with my maker. If you're listening, Saint Benedict, help me out, buddy. Protect my body and my soul, but mostly my body. My heart skipped a beat as my index finger gave way. Then a hand grabbed my wrist. My eyes snapped open. It was Texas. My first thought was that he was trying to pry me loose. But he reached out his other hand for my forearm. He was pulling me toward him. With one great burst of energy, he yanked me into the train, and we both fell to the floor. Dan's gun was tucked into the front of the biker's jeans, digging into my hip bone. Dan was slumped in the corner, eyes closed. "The name's Jeremy," Texas shouted over the hiss of the tracks and the wind. His southern drawl was far less pronounced, on account of his busted nose. "I'm with the Drug Enforcement Agency." "So you were following us yesterday," he shook his head. "I had no idea that was you driving that Escalade, not until you showed up at the clubhouse. Good thing I didn't back into you. That would have really put a dent in your operation, and your bike," he grunted in the affirmative. I lifted myself off him. "Waited long enough to save my ass just now, didn't you?" "To be fair, you gave me quite the stinger," Jeremy said, pinching his nose. "You have the drugs? They're in Capriotti's jacket." The train was drawing closer and closer to the station. We were going slower than usual, though, and decelerating at a rapid pace. "Did you ask the engineer to stop the train?" I asked Jeremy. He got to his feet. "I couldn't risk contacting anyone. Maybe the open door triggered an alarm. Or maybe..." I braced myself against the wall. I searched the horizon, not sure what I expected to see. A fleet of cop cars? A helicopter packed with Navy SEALs? The 44th president on the back of a unicorn? Instead, what I saw was a blur of leather and denim as Jeremy tumbled out of the train. His body smashed into the rocks along the tracks and was out of view within seconds. The Acela couldn't have been going more than 30 or 40, but even that was 30 or 40 miles per hour too fast when it comes to falling out of a locomotive. I turned around. Dan was on his feet, feeling the back of his head. He looked at the fresh blood on his fingers.
"He got me good," Dan grinned. "I got him better."
The train came to a smooth stop in the middle of the warehouse district, stomach-churningly close to where Dan and Taylor had staged Finn's accident. The conductor came over the intercom and asked everyone to remain in their seats. Dan and I wouldn't be interrupted, unless an Amtrak employee decided to move between cars. Outside, beneath the low hum of the overhead electrical wires that powered the train, I could hear a cacophony of sirens growing in the distance. Dan could, too. His eyes flicked from me to the open door. I was standing between him and freedom. "Papa Biden told me never to back someone into a corner, or the only way out is through you." Papa Biden had never met a stone-cold killer like Dan Capriotti. The keys were still hanging out of the control panel to my right. If I hit the correct button, the door behind me would close. Dan would be trapped. Trouble was, there were half a dozen buttons. Hit the wrong one and the other exit door behind Dan might open instead, letting him waltz his way to freedom.
"How'd you know I was lying?" he asked.
Neither of us were in any kind of shape to duke it out. He was still bleeding badly from the blow Texas had given him. He appeared woozy, like he was concussed. The hit I'd taken to the temple wasn't as bad. Still, if he slipped past me, there was no way I could catch him in a foot race, not with my bad knee. "You first," I said. "What's my tell?"
"Easy. You're a politician. You're all phony. I can tell when you're lying because you move your lips."
"If that's how you see me, then you were right. We were never friends." Dan grinned. I couldn't believe this was the same guy I'd met at Earl's just a few days earlier. All the time I'd known him, he'd been wearing a mask. One of us was phony, and it wasn't me.
"You want to hit me," Dan said, goading me on. "I'm not armed. I'm already bleeding. A couple of hits is all it would take. I'd drop easy, just like Finn Donnelly. I'm not like you. I'm not a killer. Texas, Finn, Alvin." He waved a finger at me. "Whoa! Alvin Harrison overdosed. That was all him. I found him after he'd already stopped breathing. I was in the apartment when you showed up, pressed up against the wall in the hallway. If you'd only looked to your right, you would have seen me. I don't know if you got lucky or I did. It doesn't matter now." "I'd say your luck has run out." The sirens were getting louder by the second. "You wanted to know how I knew you were lying. I didn't know for sure, not really, until I came back from the restroom and found the drugs were missing. So if I just stayed put, you might have gotten away with it. But here we are." I heard a familiar thump, 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 like a racing heartbeat. No, it was my heartbeat. But there was something else, too. Not a sound, but a feeling. A violent rumble shaking the ground. It was as if a great chasm were about to open beneath us and swallow us whole. "If you turn me in, hundreds of criminals are going to go free," Dan said. "Everyone I've ever arrested. They'll all walk. I've arrested some bad, bad men. You think the streets are dangerous now? Wait till you see this town in 6 months. It'll be on fire. Do you really want to be responsible for that?" He shook his head slowly. "Step aside, Joe." Dan smiled. He was right, and he knew it. Convictions would be overturned if they depended on his testimony. Not every one of his arrests, but enough. Not enough to make me rethink turning him in, however. I slapped the big red button on the wall. The exit door behind Dan hissed open. He spun around. I hit the button again, but the door was stuck. Dan wasted no time. He slipped through the door and jumped off the train. His boots landed hard on the rocks, but he didn't lose his balance. The rumble was growing louder. Dan jogged a couple steps, then paused on the other set of tracks. At first I thought maybe he twisted an ankle or jammed a knee when he leapt out. But no. He turned around to face me. His lips twisted into a wry smile. He put his index finger and middle fingers up to his eyebrow and bid me adieu with a good old-fashioned two-finger salute. I was contemplating whether to return the gesture or shoot him a one-fingered salutation when he was hit by a screeching train. Chapter 50.
The first vehicle to arrive on the scene wasn't a police car or an ambulance. It was an Escalade. The little beast plowed through the 6-foot chain-link fence and skidded to a stop inches from the open door of the train where I was sitting. The interior sliding doors on either side of the vestibule were locked. I'd peek through one of the windows, hoping to converse with the conductor or the cafe attendant. Employees and passengers were bent over in their seats, heads between their knees, hands covering the backs of their necks, waiting for the all-clear from law enforcement. Steve hopped out of the driver's side door. He left the SUV idling.
"Is Dan neutralized?" I said, nodding over my shoulder. "Hit by another train."
The Acela that hit Dan had finally come to a rest farther down the tracks. I didn't know where it threw his body, and I didn't care. The cadaver dogs would be around soon enough to start the search for what was left of him.
"Help is on the way," Steve said, examining the bulge on my temple.
He looked like he needed help more than I did. He had a shoulder sling on his left arm and was still wearing his hospital bracelet.
"Brock got my message," I said.
A slight breeze blew through the vestibule. Steve moved a finger back and forth in front of my face. I followed it with my eyes.
"He didn't leave a message, so the president didn't think anything of it, really. In the meantime, though, I contacted the DEA to straighten some things out. They told us they were investigating Detective Capriotti. That, of course, raised some red flags, and when we couldn't reach you, well..."
"How'd you find me?"
"Traced your phone, of course."
"That takes a court order, doesn't it? You can't do it in real time."
"If you're suggesting President Obama has some sort of backdoor into the officially dismantled NSA surveillance program, say no more," I said.
They'd had the train stopped. That was what mattered. If it hadn't been for them, Dan could have slipped away when the conductor opened the cabin doors at Wilmington Station.
"There's a man," I said. "Jeremy, a drug enforcement agent, undercover. He was the biker we chased yesterday. Dan threw him off the train a couple of hundred yards back."
"There's a medical helicopter on the way," Steve said. "We'll have them look for him."
Barack stepped out of the SUV. He was wearing the Phillies cap again.
"What do we miss?" he asked. "Did you and Dan fight it out in the top of the train?"
I climbed down onto the tracks and pointed to the electrical cables running over the tracks.
"Touch one of those and you'll be fried to the tune of 25,000 volts.
Guess they don't call you Amtrak Joe for nothing."
"I know some things," I admitted.
A trio of cop cars pulled into the gravel parking lot on the other side of the fence, lights flashing. They killed their sirens. A police helicopter circled overhead.
"They're not going to give us a hard time, are they?" I asked.
"Lieutenant Esposito's in charge," Steve said, "so maybe."
Barack ran his hands over the Escalade's bumper.
The little beast had sustained minor damage in the weekend's festivities. There was a scratch or two on the hood, a minor dent on the front side panel, if you looked at it in the right light. Other than that, it could have been fresh off the lot.
"We'll run through a car wash on the way home," Barack announced to no one in particular.
Steve answered his phone. He waved up to the helicopter, letting someone, Esposito, on the other end of the line, know that they could call off the SWAT team. There was a loud clank behind me. I turned in time to see a bloodied, mangled figure entering the train vestibule through the far door that was stuck open. There was nothing human about the creature, except for the whites of his eyes. It was Dan. He'd been torn to shreds. Somehow, despite it all, he'd found a way to gather his broken limbs into something resembling a human form. His breathing was shallow, ragged. In his right hand he held a snub-nosed pistol, which he must have hidden in a holster. I realized he could have pulled it out and shot me during our standoff, but he hadn't. Perhaps he'd had second thoughts about killing me. Perhaps he'd simply known it was futile. Now, however, he was past rational thought. He was fueled by rage, a thirst for revenge.
"Gun!"
I yelled. I launched myself shoulder first into Barack, knocking him to the ground and out of harm's way. Steve dropped his phone and pulled out his own piece. The smell of gunpowder was in the air. Shots had been fired. I hadn't even heard them. All I could hear was the ringing in my ears. I was lying on top of Barack and rolled off onto the rocks. Steve was racing for us, gripping his smoking Sig Sauer with his one good hand. The shootout was over. Dan was finally dead. Barack and Steve helped me up into a sitting position. Barack showed no signs of injury. It took a lot more than an old man to knock the wind out of him. I grabbed my aching lump handle, and my index finger went through a tiny hole in my bomber jacket. A bullet hole. I'd been hit. Barack threw open my jacket and patted me down. There was no blood, no entry or exit wound on the pink skin of my abdomen.
"It went through your jacket but missed your body," he said, his voice muffled.
My hearing was slowly coming back. "You're lucky to be alive."
"It wasn't luck," I said.
I reached into my pocket and pulled out the bullet. Its nose was bent at an angle. I tossed it into the sand. There was a small dent, almost dead center, in the Medal of Freedom, with cracks in the enamel overlay radiating around it. The dent would need to be pounded out, and the paint would need touching up. I knew my auto body guy would fix it for a pittance, especially compared to what a jeweler might charge. All in all, the medal wasn't in bad shape. And, all things considered, neither was I.
Chapter 51. Steve and I gave statements to the Wilmington PD. Steve's hands were trembling. He'd never shot someone before. My hands weren't the steadiest either. I'd never been shot before. Neither of us mentioned the president playing games on his BlackBerry. Dan wouldn't be mentioning him either. The fact that Dan had died instead of entering the Delaware penal system was probably for the best. The Marauders would have surely put a hit out on him once they found out what he'd done to Taylor. Esposito approached me after I'd finished giving my statement.
"I should apologize for being so hard on you," she said.
"You should, but
I don't believe in apologies."
I shook her hand. "I appreciate the gesture, nonetheless." She promised a full internal investigation into Detective Capriotti's illicit activities. I didn't blame her or her department. I believe that the Wilmington police force did the best they could with the tools they were given. Police officers were, by and large, good people. A single bad egg, however, was all it took to spoil the bunch, at least as far as public perception is concerned. It would be up to Esposito to clean up the mess. A pair of DEA officers, one man, one woman, introduced themselves to me. I recognized their names from the search warrant for the Donnelly's home.
"Do you have a moment to chat?" the female agent said.
An EMT was wrapping a blood pressure cuff around my upper arm.
"As long as you don't say anything to spike my numbers," I said.
They explained to me that the Marauders' trafficking encompassed the entire eastern seaboard. The scheme involving Finn Donnelly had been just one piece of a larger pie they were tracking. I apologized for royally screwing their investigation, but they told me not to sweat it. When they realized Dan Capriotti was crooked, the entire DEA operation had been thrown into disarray. The DEA couldn't trust Esposito or anyone else in the Wilmington PD. They didn't know how far the conspiracy to tax the Marauders' local chapter went, or if Finn Donnelly had truly gone into business for himself. For a while, everyone who crossed their radar had been suspect.
"Including me," I said.
The agents looked at each other, but didn't deny the charge. "We had an undercover operative and an informant to protect," the female agent said. "We couldn't trust anyone."
"Jeremy was the undercover operative. Who was the informant?"
"Alvin Harrison," she said. He was dead now, and the operation had fizzled out, so there was no risk in revealing his name. He'd turned in a tip that Finn was smuggling something.
"So, rather than confront Finn directly,"
the male agent cleared his throat.
"There was a reward involved, a substantial reward."
It couldn't have been easy for Alvin to turn in one of his railroad brothers. I wanted to believe Alvin had been motivated by more than money. A sense of justice, perhaps. I assumed that Alvin had his reasons for doing what he did, just as Finn had his reasons for doing what he did. Whatever the reasoning behind Alvin's actions, I now understood the pit of despair he'd fallen into after the accident. Even though Finn was already dead when Alvin's train hit him, Alvin had killed him, in a way, and he'd known it. The weight had been too much to bear. Even though the good guys ultimately prevailed, the bad guys had landed some hard punches. Dan's betrayal stung. We were entering a new age, one where there were no absolutes like right and wrong.
The worst part was that it felt like everyone else had already been living there for a long time. I was finally just catching on. Chapter 52. We retired to the lake house for the evening, and Jill cooked us a big Sunday dinner. She had a million questions, but she was willing to wait and let me rest before hearing the full story. I promised not to leave any